they're getting wild for me. And all the pretty chicks all wanna smile at me. These rap cats, man, they all got this out for me. And if I ever see them, man, they probably bow to me. And when this beat drop, I know they gon' lean. Word they be. Hello and welcome to another episode of Amon Sheeran's Pirate Radio Podcast. Today's episode, we have a huge, illustrious guest. It's been an inspiration to me throughout my career and my favorite runner of all time, Andrew Weeding. Andrew, thank you very much for coming on today.
Oh, wow. Thanks for having me. Favorite runner of all time. I'm honored. Wow, yeah. Thank you.
So we asked the hard-hitting questions here at Pirate Radio. And the first one right off the bat is it true you can choke an entire bottle of maple syrup?
It is true. It's documented somewhere. There was alcohol involved. Okay. And somewhere along the line, one can got pulled out and a bottle of maple syrup got put in. And yeah, it was in my youth. But I feel like it's kind of a tradition. If you're going to live in Vermont, you've got to be able to chug a bottle of maple syrup.
Kind of a rite of passage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, definitely. So growing up in Vermont, how'd you get started running competitively?
It was interesting. Vermont was, it's, you know, you mean you've never heard of the illustrious track athletes that come out of Vermont? There's so many of us. I grew up playing every sport you could imagine. And it's funny because running was the very last sport I found, because as we all know, running was the punishment for every other sport.
Right.
So forgive me for not gravitating to it earlier, but it's fun because there are signs along the way, like throughout my childhood, like turkey trots and like timed miles when I was a kid, and they kind of showed little glimpses of it. But it wasn't until my junior year of high school where I was trying out for the varsity soccer team. And I ran a timed mile as part of it. And 6 minutes was like the elite time. And I took it upon myself to make that like this personal challenge. And I ended up kind of lapping everyone on the who tried out. And I ran 5 minutes. And for, you know, nobody who trains for this, all the soccer coaches were kind of looking at each other like, is this kid in the right sport? and I'll never forget it. The varsity coach pulled me aside. He kind of took me into a corner and looked at me and said, hey, look, you can make varsity, but I really think you should try cross country because we could be sitting on Olympic stuff here. Wow. And I never forgot those words because, I mean, I'd never really heard of the Olympics until that kind of was said. And like any teenager would, kind of looked back at him and just started kind of giggling. It's like running cross country, but the cool kids play soccer and lacrosse and football and ice hockey and like, I'm not a runner, no. So I gave it some time, and I got pressure from a lot of teachers, a lot of friends and family a little bit, and they're like, give it a shot. You can come back, try in the spring, you know, come do soccer later, not a big deal. Gave it a shot, and I immediately loved it. That first race, I was hooked. I didn't even know what spikes were. I didn't know what, like, any sort of fitness level meant. And, I mean, I like, typical fashion, I giggled at the word fartlek, so it was like, it was classic rookie running, but I gravitated to immediately and then started winning naturally. And yeah, it was just so much fun.
So it sounds like you got a late start, but had a lot of natural talent and were naturally competitive. You said you fell in love with it right away. Is that from there that become your life? Did you look back after that, after falling in love with it?
That was it. I think soccer will always be my first love. I think it's just such a thing about it that I absolutely enjoyed. And looking back at it, you know, like I said, there were glimpses. I was spending all this time running up and playing offense, trying to score goals, and then run all the way back down and play defense, then keep going back and forth. And my coaches would be like, look, you can, like, you're a striker. You can stay at the front. Like, you don't need to keep coming all the way back and run. Like, you're running like 3-4 miles more than every other kid. Like, oh, okay. So, but yeah, I think I remember that first race. I went out there, and our captain was, I thought he was the fitness god. And I was like, okay, you are the guy to, like, just try to keep up with. And in the first maybe quarter mile or so, I was sitting in the pack behind the leaders, kind of bumping around. And I was like, I felt uncomfortable chopping my stride, trying to open it up, couldn't do it. And I was like, oh, the hell with this. So I just took off and ran. And I don't know, you know how it is when you get to the front, that
right.
Surge of energy and this adrenaline spike, and you're like, oh, I'm in front, I'm leading. And it was, that was it. It just hooked. I was never looked back. I won. And every race after that, I won. It really didn't get to, real top end competitiveness until I discovered the old Foot Locker races down in Massachusetts.
Yeah, so Foot Locker, was that a breakout race for you when you realized you had some serious potential going forward?
I think it was one of those races where I realized I was not as good as I thought I was.
Okay.
Yeah, because we were, it was like the private school Division IV category, like, you know, all the, you know, not the illustrious of talent was really known for coming out of this part of the world. And so I was like, I didn't know that. So I was winning all these races. And so my head was getting bigger and bigger. And eventually I found a Foot Locker race and I was like, okay, all right, this is where the top talent goes. Now I'm going to win here. And then I'm going to go and do it again in San Diego at the national meet. Like, I had this stupid big head where I was like, I'm going to do this all again. So, but I went down there, and true to fashion, I did the same strategy I did all my other races where I took off right out the gate from the gun. And I was like, okay, I probably got a good 30, 40 meters on him by now. Like, just how it usually goes, and I'm pretty good. I don't see anyone around, and I look over my shoulder, and sure enough, like, these guys are all lined up next to me. Oh God, oh geez. And I'm pretty sure the first mile was under 5 minutes, and that was it. I was cooked. So I was just like trying to survive the rest of the race. Like, they all flew by me. We hit the first hill, and I finished. Was it 18th, I think, in like 15:59, I think it is, or like just under 16 minutes, but. And then that was the moment where I was like, okay, I am not as good as I think I am. It is time to, like, get serious here. And yeah, that was where it all kind of opened up. But I guess, yeah, it's pretty incredible seeing how you can kind of live in a bit of a bubble and then finally get a taste of that top-end talent and realize how much you suck.
Yeah, it's you can get those heat checks quickly when you're kind of brought back to earth and remind yourself that there's a lot of good guys out there. Do you remember having a breakout race on the track that made you realize you could compete at the top level in college?
Yeah, there was, I mean, I think it was maybe a couple of them. Each race in high school, it's interesting. We didn't have a track program in my high school. I had to kind of flush out a potential coach and kind of do it all on the side while playing basketball, like JV basketball. And yeah, I played JV for 4 years. So I don't like to brag, but I bring it up every now and then.
There you go.
So, but it was funny, like the practices would end and I'd go run around the court for the next 20 minutes while like the janitors and whatnot came in to clean everything up. And then I connected with like track coach, and you know, he was a real diamond in the rough in New Hampshire. And his name's Jeff Johnson. And if you know the history of Nike, you know, he's their first employee. I didn't know any of that. And so I was this old guy who knew track and he said he'd coach me. It sounds great. Right. But as I got to know him, it's like, oh, this guy named the company, this guy was their first employee. This guy was, wow, it's deep roots into that. But I just was captivated by his stories of Prefontaine and running in general. So when I met him, I was a 5K runner. He told me, he's like, you know, you should consider, we're going to put you in the 1500s. Ah, but it's short. That's short and fast. I don't want to do that.
It's like the opposite of what everyone says.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of that, he's like, and then we're going to do a time trial 800 before your first race. Wow. Ah, that's the worst race. Why do you want to do an 800? So he took me out. We did an 800 at like a low-key meet, and I was just time trialing 158. That's the only 800 I ran in high school. And then we went to 1500 the following weekend, and I ran about, I think it was 410 or 415 or something like that. But like I was told to stay quiet until the last 200. So I did exactly that, and then I just gunned down the last 200 and ran past everybody. And this is like the B or C heat of that event. And Jeff was like, okay, we're putting you into the A heat at the Dartmouth event with all the college road level racers. Like, you're going after it. Like, okay, cool. So similar strategy, but it was a faster pace. And last 200, just gunned down. And I finished, I think, second or third to a couple of good names from Dartmouth. And at that point, Jeff was like, you need to be aware. Like, this is you're going to the 1500 and you should apply to Oregon. And he like basically just dropped all this knowledge on me like right after the race. Like, Oregon, Ducks, Vinland as a coach, we'll get in touch, throw an application in, end of story. I was like, okay. I probably couldn't figure out where Oregon was on a map, but he was adamant that I apply.
Right. So when he tells you to apply, do you know the prestige and history of the University of Oregon and Prefontaine? Do you know all these stories going into it?
A little bit. Okay. I mean, he mentioned Prefontaine, and Prefontaine is like a big reason why I got into running. I had a Spanish teacher who wouldn't shut up about it. And okay. He goes, Prefontaine, Prefontaine, Prefontaine. I'm like, stop. I don't want to learn about this guy now because you just force fed it to me. So I'm not even going to take the time to learn. And then eventually, like as these races are kind of unfolding, I'm like, all right, I will watch this without limits. I will watch this fire on the track. I will try it. And sure enough, like you watch those movies, and as soon as the credits start to roll, you just want to run out the door and just go run a marathon because you're so inspired. And at that point, like just as Jeff's telling me how to do all this stuff, I'm just discovering the history and the heritage. And I'm like, you think I have the potential to go to that school with that history, with all of that? I have a chance. He's like, yeah, you're going to Oregon. Okay, you say so. So. He taught me a lot about it, and it's a big reason that I went there for it, because of him.
So when you step on campus, you're surrounded by guys like Centro, Rupp, all these guys. Is that intimidating at all, going into it with such talent around you?
It's funny you would think. And when I think about it now, if I was going into a setting like that, this brain, I would think, okay, these are the best guys. I am so scared, but I'm a little nervous. But high school me was like, Roop? Who's Roop? I'm gonna beat that guy. I totally had this ego about myself. I was like, okay, I know I'm on the bottom of the totem pole, but I'm not staying on the bottom of the totem pole. And so I just went in there with this ego. Galen, humble as can be, he's kind of took us all in. Like, he was the captain. I was just like looking at him from amongst the bushes with all the other scrubby runners. Like, I will beat you. thankfully, I never got the chance, because I'm pretty sure Galen would have wiped me across the track.
Yeah. So, what was that process like? Such a great team. What was your college experience like? Waking up every day and working out with maybe the best team, collegiate team ever.
Sure. Yeah. It was interesting. We had the number one recruiting class that year, and I'd been following through like Diestat and all the websites. To that point, all I wanted as a high school kid to have my name on this website with the rankings of everyone. And I followed all the top guys. And sure enough, now, like 4 months, 5 months later, here we are standing in a group together collectively. I'm like looking at them like, my name was on that website. And all you guys, I'm cool too. So, but it was really unique, because it also kind of made me realize I've looked up to these guys my whole high school career, like the whole last year. I know how good you guys all are. I know you don't really know me. You guys have all been to Foot Locker Nationals, to Nike Outdoor Nationals, to Junior Nationals. You had all these meets where you guys all overlapped again and again and again. And in comes this little no-namer from Vermont. And I was very much aware that I had some proving to do. But I took that as a personal challenge, and was like, okay, if I'm going to be low man, I'm not going to stay here. So, but the hard part for me was, it wasn't the running piece. It was just the college being across the country from my family piece. Mm-hmm. And to all freshmen or soon to be freshmen, there is a part or portion of that where it's difficult. And I was damn close to transferring because of it. Wow. Thankfully, my teammates, it's easy to kind of lock yourself away and just kind of sit in self-pity, which, the running wasn't going great. It's my first year jumping from like 50 miles a week to like 70, and I naturally got hurt. It was easy to want to quit, but I definitely turned to my teammates and I leaned on them, and they kind of pulled me into the late night Halo matches, mm-hmm. into going out and getting ice cream, to like the short shorts running and goofy basketball attempts. Like, it's all these silly things that I'll never forget. It just kind of helped take my mind away from the family I'm missing to this new creation, my new family that I've created, and then just helped really push me forward.
Yeah, there's nothing better than the boys between Halo and basketball, like you were saying. Who was your core workout group that helped push you in college?
I'd say it's probably AJ Acosta. was a big part of it. There's a couple of 800 meter runners, Jeremy Liebman and AJ Castile were two names that were like always, I was always in workouts with them. And AJ kind of floated within the 1500 5k range and I was floating 15, 800 range. Mm-hmm. And so we overlapped in a couple of workouts. And every now and then I go jump in with like, you know, Elijah Greer or Mac Fleet would come in. And Ascentro would pop in for a couple workouts. But, I kind of gravitated to the more, like, short, faster group.
Gotcha. All right, cool. So moving on to some of your national wins at 1500 and 800, what do you remember those races running at Tracktown and all these great successes in your college career? What was your strategy going into those races?
I mean, it's interesting to talk. Like, strategy to me kind of changed with every year. Freshman year, it was just like survive, get to the end of the race and whatever you can muster, finish with it. My sophomore year was just this cacophony of euphoric fun. I was this no-name guy who was just kind of popping up, getting a little bit louder on the radar, slowly creeping up the rankings. And I didn't know much about workouts. I didn't know the education of running. I didn't know like VO2 maxes, fartleks, tempos, hill running, all this like knowledge of the sport. I was literally just showing up. We didn't run this. You got it. And I'd go run it. And I got to credit Vin for recognizing how stupid I was and using it to my advantage. So, so that was the whole sophomore year. It was like, okay, similar to last year, I'm just going to try and survive and see what we got the last 200. And that last 200 suddenly turned into my strongest weapon. And I was just kicking down every race for again and again and again. And before you knew it, that kick got me into the Olympics. So each year kind of drafted a new sense of strategy. But yeah, through sophomore year, it was just fun. And then, yeah, junior was like, just find your moment and make it count. And senior year is like, hey, we're here, we're at the end, why not go big?
Yeah, there you go. That's something I really admired always watching your racing is your confidence to trust your kick at the end of the race, something I was never quite able to do. And you said that kick earned you a spot in the Olympics. In 2008, you make your first Olympic team. What was it like going into the trials and what was it like making that team? What did that mean to you?
Oh man, you want to talk about a career changing race. It was the 2008 800 meter Olympic trial race. I was second by a hundredth of a second to Jacob Hernandez at the NCAAs. I wasn't mad about it. I ran 1:45. I was like, that's 5 seconds faster than I ran last year. I'm fine with second for now. And then the trials came around and I'd been in Eugene that whole year, just watching the stadium kind of build out, the buzz get created, and hearing Vin talk about the spectacle of what Tracktown is and the magic of Hayward Field, all of these things that kind of, you know, as a young duck, you're hearing more and more about through like the older heritage of older ducks and kind of the lineage, kind of all these rumors trickle in. And to that point, I'd never lived in the 70s. I didn't see Freeze era. I never lived or seen a race that kind of that got to that hype. I saw Galen Rupp just squeak out Chris Selinski in a 5K at Hayward, and we all went nuts for that. That was such a monumental moment for me. And then the pre-classic came in, you're like, okay, this is the biggest top-end athletes in the world. Like, this is amazing. Sub 4 minute mile, all of them ran that.
Right.
And so here comes the trials on par with those kind of on par with that excitement. And I didn't really know what the weight of top three at this event meant. Because I didn't grow up with the Olympics in my head. I thought World Cup and FIFA was it for my future. So going into trials, it was just fun. Vin said, we're not going to put any expectation on it. Trust your instincts. Like, you know yourself. Just keep having fun with it. Just do it. First round comes in, and I stuck to my standard routine, sit, kick. And when you hit the home stretch and you see people in front of you, that grit just takes over. And the Hayward crowd kind of pushed me to the finish and got through. The semifinal was the hardest race of the three. I felt coming across that line, my legs felt heavy at the start. I was a little nervous. I didn't know if Jacob Hernandez was in that race or in one of the couple races. He'd beaten me, but I ended up winning, get to the final. And then the final, it was just like, just instinct took over. I'd done the same thing I'd done on every race prior. Nick Simmons and I, we'd seen each other throughout the year. He dressed up as a Playboy Bunny at one of our parties. So I was like, dude, I'm not scared of Nick. I know how good he is, but like, I'm not threatened because of his ego or anything. I know how talented he is. But he's more friend than foe. And so we went running and we came around with a lap to go. And he was sitting right next to me. And I kind of wanted to lean over and be like, all right, bud, let's do this. Come on, let's do this. Cause you just had that team feel. It's like I all year, the Ducks, I just wanted to do it for the team, do it for the team. I was like, I wanted to do it. I felt like we were on team again. Come around 200 to go. And Dwayne had shot forward. It was getting me a little antsy. I was getting a little nervous. And then Nick pops out. That was like a slap to my face. Like, okay, time to go. Let's go. Rev it up. Let's go. We come around 100 meters to go, and Nick's already got the lead and pulling away. I'm in like sixth, seventh, creeping by fifth, fourth. And with each person, you can hear the decibels in the stadium going up, you know, fourth, and then it's the third. And all of a sudden it's deafening. Like I couldn't hear myself breathe. Couldn't hear myself think. Into second place, and then maybe 5-10 meters before the finish line, it suddenly realized, it was just dawning on me, oh my God, I'm going to the Olympics. This is an Olympic spot. My jaw drops open, and it's like in those movies where everything slows down, and you can just hear like a heartbeat, and then everything speeds back up, and you fly across the line, and it's like, oh my God. So that was easily the race in my career that put me from like, college kid pretty good to okay, you're world class, now you gotta figure it out.
That was definitely a career defining race. You talked about everything speeds back up as you cross the line. You cross the line and you realize you're gonna represent your country at the Olympic level. What does that mean to you?
Oh man, I wish I could say in that moment I was like overflowing with emotion, like tears. I wish I could say I know how important, how heavy, how big this means. At the time, I didn't know any of this. Now I have such a much bigger, more huge respect for what it means to make an Olympic team. But when you know, 20 years old, you've never watched an Olympic race in your life. I've never watched one thing that had the Olympic rings on it. And now all of a sudden, I'm going to represent this, my country, on the biggest stage in the world, where it just seemed like it was like, something like 30 months prior, I was just time trying at 800 meters for the first time in 158 in front of like parents and their siblings or their kids. And now 30 months later, here I am on the biggest stage in this same event. So, it was very, very, fast learning. And I saw it on the faces of people who all went there. The experience of going to this warehouse and pulling all this USA kit off shelves, and then going to China and walking through this village where everyone is just praised as gods. And I'm looking around, looking at like thinking everyone else is these godly people. Like, you know, I have to be cool because I'm one of the fastest guys in the world, and I have to play this role. I'm one of the best. I deserve to be here. But in my head, it's like, oh my God, that's Kobe Bryant. Oh my God. Oh my God. So I'm still a kid, and to finally walk out on the stage during the opening ceremonies, I think that's when it really started to hit you, because you got this whole stadium exploding. You see people with USA flags, and suddenly it was like my Duck family grew into a USA family, which is, you know, a few hundred thousand turned into a few hundred million, and I'm like, wow, this is one hell of a team. And so the overwhelming feeling of emotion came a little bit later. But as with that, so did a bit of expectation.
So I asked my friends what something they would like to ask you. One of my friends came up with, what was the athlete village experience like? Was there intermingling with other countries? Was there like secret parties? Anything fun like that?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
All right.
I have signed,
I respect that.
I've signed the contract. I can't confirm or deny any activity.
All right, definitely.
But it lives up to the bill, I'll tell you that. It's definitely a lot of fun in there.
All right, definitely.
I think that's about as much as I'm allowed to divulge.
All right, I certainly respect that. NDAs and such, you wouldn't want to break any of those. throughout your career, from a fan's perspective, one of the greatest rivalries in recent memories, you and Robbie Andrews, you competed against each other. What was it like racing against him? Know he's going to be there in the last 50 meters. Did he push you to your best?
Yes. Nothing but the most respect for Robbie. Him and I are still great friends. Even during the rivalries, there was never any bad blood. But for that less than 2 minutes, I was willing to, you know, break kneecaps to win, as I'm sure Robbie would say the same. So, it was, there's a piece to racing that kind of changes you when there's a bit of the fear of losing that creeps into your head.
Right.
And up until I met Robbie, it was like, this excitement and thrill of winning, and like, I'm going to win. I'm getting like this strong confidence was just always radiating. And not to say I had a huge ego, but it was like, you know, I'm going in with this confidence and excitement of wanting to win. Comes along this competitor, this rival, this enemy, if you will, who all of a sudden puts the fear of loss in your head, and suddenly the scales are a bit tipped. And, you know, when Robbie swung through indoors and beat me in the 800, that was like this eye-opening moment, because I was, 20 years old, kicking down these elite athletes and winning, and in comes this younger, like 19, 20-year-old coming in, and as my friends like to tell me, I got weeding. this little kid swoops by and beats me. I was happy for him. You can see this pure, authentic joy and excitement on his face, which was very relatable. I didn't want to, it's great. But, he takes the cameras and walks away. I step off the track with this, like, fuming anger and this gut-wrenching frog in my throat. And, like, I just wanted to cry or punch something. I don't know if I wanted, emotions were all over the place. Because losing is the worst. Losing sucks. Mm-hmm. Suddenly having my confidence kind of tested like that, it was like, okay, you're not going to win. You need to learn to lose. So this was like a big learning moment. So you can only imagine how angry I was after Penn Relays when Robbie nipped me at the line again there. I had to give him a little like handshake, good job, takes the camera, walks away again. And I like, and it's even more gut wrenching when you lose for three other people. Right. And you're like, I lost it for all you guys. I was impatient and I didn't wait and I lost it. So you go have every right to be mad at me, and I'm no more mad at myself. So, but then when NCAAs came around, it was one of those moments where I looked back at the 08 trials race, and Nick had the ego and confidence and knew exactly how to run this race to get away from me. Cause he had openly said that he had heard that I was coming on quick, and the way to beat me was to have the lead going into 100 meters to go. I saw and heard that, looked at my 2010 800 meter final, was like, look, I got to do what Nick did to me in 08. And so I did exactly what Nick did. I fired off with 200 meters to go, made sure I had the lead going into the last 100, and just kept pulling away and didn't give Robbie a chance. So it took two brutally beaten losses, and the third, if you want to consider Nick's loss, to really learn how to run that race to my fullest. But in the end, I love the Andrews family. Like they're all amazing. Like, Robbie's been such a great friend, and like I've gotten to know his family pretty well. And like, we can hate each other on the track all day long, but at the end of the day, we're still gonna break bread and have some beers together.
There you go. That's the name of the game. Throughout your career, you dealt with some pretty serious injuries that set you back. How did you remind yourself of the long term goal when you were dealing with some of those injuries?
Oh man, injuries are the worst. Yeah. God, injuries are the worst.
I know.
Yeah, you think losing sucks? I mean, at least you got the chance. Sitting on the bench watching others compete, that's the worst, the absolute worst. There have been a few instances where I've had to deal with injuries and have been stuck sitting on the bench or not in the final watching friends and competitors go as far as win medals. And it's the most agonizing feeling. I don't think I felt it more than in 2012. I made it back to the Olympics, and I had to sit there in a bar with my family, kind of just enjoying beers and family friends and watching the 1500 final on TV and seeing Leo get silver and Matt get fourth. And I was like, I can beat those guys. And I tore my plantar that year. I couldn't really put it together. So it's a really heart-wrenching feeling. But again, we're all competitors. We want to win, and it's hard to feel happy for others when you know you have the talent.
Right. So I'm just going to cut you off real quick. I can only record for 30 minutes, so I'm going to pause and come right back. So you're just talking about dealing with summer injuries, especially in 2012 when you got to watch the final with your family from the outside looking in.
Yeah. And 12 was a semi-torn plantar fasciitis issues of all sorts. And I did as much as I could to make it. And I got to the semifinals. It was great. But anyway, the point of all that is, when you feel that gut-wrenching feeling, you had to kind of dig deep to think, and you have to get back to where you once were. You have to remind yourself of how great it was having been there before.
Right.
And so, I mean, it just sat and thought, okay, the high of winning the NCAA meet with Matt and AJ, or going to the 800, going in the 800 2008, winning the in the indoor title as a team, like all these moments that really kind of warmed my heart to the sport, I had to kind of fall on and be like, look, this is why you love this. You don't suck at it. You're not a bad athlete. You just caught some bad luck. Just don't give up. And that's what you really have to really lean on when the recovery process starts. Cause I'll tell you, you put as much weight in front of me as you want and I'll find a way to lift it. But you put a towel on the ground and you tell me to curl it up with my toes, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. That is the most annoying, stupid little thing that is the most important piece to running, strengthening the little muscles. And it taught me a whole lot about patience.
Yeah, there you go. I think I was watching the piece FloTrack did on you, and you were kind of in the pool reminding yourself of those things. So that was really inspiring because I've dealt with 2 broken ankles in high school and injuries in college. So kind of reminded me to just keep pushing and keep those long-term goals in mind. So thank you for that.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. So obviously great career, touched on the Olympics, NCAA finals, all that stuff. Looking back on your career, is there anything you could like wish you would have done, or any regrets that you have?
Obviously there's a little bit of that. When you get older, you look back and think, what were you thinking, or why didn't you do this or do that? And there was something like I ran, so after Monaco, after my senior year, like all this great success, these extremely fast times, things to be incredibly proud of, I still was a little naive as to what I was accomplishing, and I don't think I respected the time that I ran or my place in the world rankings as much as I did. Because after Monaco, I think I was fourth there, and that put me like fourth in the world. And it was like, cool, like that's still not on the podium. And I kept looking at it as podium, I gotta be top three, which, competing and wanting that thirst for first is absolutely, in my opinion, way more important than the time that you run. And so you run 3:30. I was like, great, that's really fast. That's really cool. But I still finished fourth, which is what all I could think about. I was fourth. So I didn't respect it. And so we'd step off the track. I'd go into off season. And, I'd enjoy a few drinks with friends. I'd kind of, get tempted in different directions. And then time to ramp back up and start training again. And I remember Russell Brown, I was saying, him and he was my training partner or track club, him and I were talking about what to expect next summer, how to get ready for this and this and that. And I think I was just kind of dealing with a bit of a hamstring issue, and I was just like, oh, it's fine. I think I'll make top three and I'll just go run 3:32 or something. And he was like, you say that so
casually.
Cavalier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Casually. Like 3:32 is not some like casual day on the track. Like that's a very, very impressive time. And I was like, I ran 3:30. It's 2 seconds slow. I'll be fine. And he was like, it just showed me, like looking back now, it just showed me how much I didn't respect or really know or understand how hard it is to run those times. Cause after that year, I was fourth in 2011 at USA's, but Legat didn't go. And that was like a real heartbreaking moment. And I struggled with, like, hamstring issues to calf to plantar, and I got fourth and losing to, you know, it's hard. So I remember we kind of breaking down a little bit because Bernard came over and said, "Hey, I'm not going to go. Like, you're going to go to Daegu and represent USA." And I just kind of started crying. Like, this hurts. Like, everything about this hurts. I'm very thankful, but this hurts. If I could look back, I guess, to get back to it, I would respect what I accomplished more, and taken a bit more of my training, a little bit, I would have buttoned it up a bit more. There are a few workouts I'd show up a little hungover, and I'd tell Russell that, and I'd kind of have a great workout and then kind of go off and goof off a little bit more. Like, I just didn't respect it enough. And you could see each year kind of get a little bit worse. And I don't know, then expectation plays a role, and then finding a way to deal with expectation, and then the pressures of contracts, requirements, and things like that all kind of started to play a role. And I wish I'd done better to find outlets that weren't so negative to my training.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's definitely an interesting perspective, and one you can probably only find after the fact. But obviously, you had a great career. I've enjoyed following you as much during your career as post-career now, following like Treklandia, all the fun stuff you do on YouTube, all that. So what's that been like in your retirement life?
Yeah, no, retirement life has been it's been great. It's fine. I've been to a few track meets since, and a lot of the main question is, do you miss it? And I'll tell you, I miss showing up and goofing around with like my friends and like warming up and cooling down and like, you know, talking about who did what on video games and like silly stories and they're chasing girls. I'm all the silly the goofiness of being an athlete, but I miss none of the training, the intensity and stress and pressure of racing. It's just the social atmosphere that I completely missed. But being retired, it's amazing. I found love, engaged, I've got a house.
Congratulations.
Life. Yeah, thank you. And it's been great kind of finding the balance, the other side of the fence, if you will. And so the Treklandia stuff was fun. It's good. I've always thought the sport needs more storytelling and not so much hear the numbers, the results. And I love hearing, like who lanes 1 and 2 and 7 and 8 are all about. Cause we all know who those middle lanes are. I love putting athletes in situations that have nothing to do with their athletic ability. So a lot of what Treklandia was to me, the fun was creating the game at the end of the show. You know, you do the interview, you get to know the athlete, but then, hey, can you make a splint out of a Barbie doll and saran wrap? Ready, go. Yeah. And so seeing them just play with these toys, it humanizes people. And I think that's what makes the track fun, is finding a connection to athletes. Finding sport fun is a connection to athletes in a way that you can feel within yourself.
Yeah, I definitely totally agree with that. I think track needs more personality. And I think in many ways you paved the way for guys like Craig Angle and guys who are showing a lot of personality by just being yourself on and off the track. So I think that was pretty monumental in the coverage of track.
Yeah. Craig could probably have his own TV show at this point.
Yeah, exactly. He's traveling across country in his van with his mullet and his stash, so you gotta love Craig. And he's obviously maybe the top 2 or 3 1500 meter runners in the country, so it's very fun to watch. Couple fun questions before I let you go. If you could have dinner with any dead celebrity or athlete, who would it be and why?
I mean, this is an obvious answer is Steve Prefontaine.
Right. Yes.
You see the videos. I've heard nonstop stories. Through Jeff and through like all the old ducks, they've all have a Prefontaine story. And I'm like, I honestly think we probably have a pretty good dinner of just drinking beer and just bullshitting about track, which should be perfectly fine. But then there's also the other side, like, okay, if you have to pull away from running, what would it be? And I'd like to sit down with Kobe Bryant.
There you go. Another popular.
Yeah. Taken too early, but both of them taken too early. And it's like, I've always heard about Kobe's intensity and his focus and his ability to train and really push through those like early mornings, late nights, like just get to make sure the results are always there when they need them, when he needs them. I would have loved to have heard in more detail about like how he got his brain and mind just so laser focused, and how and if it played a role in his own personal life. And just, I don't know, the guy was a grinder and I respected it.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, you had a picture with you, Centro, and Kobe at the opening ceremony. What was that like for you to take that picture?
Yeah, it was the 800. It was Nick, myself, and Christian Smith.
Oh, okay.
And then Kobe. And yeah, it was interesting because in 08, that was LeBron was like 24, I think. Mm-hmm. And Kobe was probably like 28, 29. He was in the older years.
Right.
LeBron was very charismatic and friendly, which, you know, the youth, you could see his youth. He's all like, hey, chatting, talking, hey, working with you, this energy. And you could just see Kobe was like, look, I'm here. I love what this is all about. I want to experience it. But at the end of the day, I'm here to win a basketball game. And you could just read it on his face. He's like, everyone in the room wanted a photo. And he would just, he was very courteous to it. Just quick smile, 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 photo. But you could read it clear as can be. He's like, look, I don't want to enjoy a moment of this until I've got a medal around my neck. And I got to respect it. Like, that's absolutely right. Like, and LeBron has like young first Olympics. Like, he's just enjoying the ride. Like, his career is blossoming in this illustrious goat-like career, and Kobe's setting the pace, and he's just along for the fun. You can see the two different personalities, and then part of me, I kind of felt a little of that with some of the older guys on the Olympic team and myself. Mm-hmm. I was wide-eyed and bug-eyed and everything, and others were like, look, this is fun, but the longer I'm on my feet, the more time I have to recover. Like, they're always thinking, I'm here to win a race. And I was pretty cool experience to see the two personalities, but Kobe was very courteous considering everybody wanted a photo with him.
Yeah, that's very cool. Two different perspectives, but I think the older you get, the more you realize that it is about the final and not about the ceremony. So that's awesome, man. I can't thank you enough. Like I said, you're my favorite runner, and I really enjoyed talking to you for this podcast.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
It's Amon, but it's all good. Don't worry.
Amon, sorry. I tried to wing it. It was really wrong.
No, don't worry. It's a tough one. But what would you like your outro song to be?
My outro song?
Yes, anything you want.
Oh, man. It's funny. We were listening to Steve Miller Band last night, and I was like really digging it. So, yeah, I probably have to go with a Steve Miller Band song. I don't know which one. Oh my God, why am I struggling to remember this?
I'll help you out. I'll do a quick Google search for some Steve Miller Band songs. He was in like another band, right? What's that? He was in like another the Rolling Stones. Yeah. Is that it? No.
Oh, I don't know if he's Rolling Stones.
No, he was in another big band. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank. Steve Miller.
That's all right. Yeah, Steve Miller Band, Slingtown. That was always a good
Slingtown.
One.
Slingtown, all right.
It kind of builds.
Yeah, all right. Thank you very much. I'll let you know when this is out. And, yeah.
Cool. Thanks. Amon.
Amon, yes, you got it.
Amon. Cool, right. Man. Well, no, I appreciate you having me on. It's awesome. I love doing this. Keep doing what you're doing. Tell the stories. Get athletes talking about them. It's always fun to hear your new perspectives.